The Guardian.
Britain goes into lockdown, but mixed messages from Number 10 continue to cause confusion. I'm Heather Stewart, and this is Politics Weekly.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home.
What a difference a week makes, eh? Since you last heard from me, measures to stem the tide of the COVID-19 outbreak have come thick and fast, and sometimes unexpectedly, from the government. At the start of March, the Prime Minister wasn't keen on the idea of closing schools.
Things like closing schools and stopping big gatherings don't work as well, perhaps, as people think.
But then last Wednesday...
Today, and Gavin Williamson is making a statement now in the House of Commons, that after schools shut their gates from Friday afternoon, they will remain closed for most pupils, for the vast majority of pupils, until further notice.
We were also advised not to go to pubs, restaurants and gyms, but for a while the government stopped short of ordering the closure of these establishments. But then last Friday he announced...
Following agreement between all the four nations of the United Kingdom, all the devolved administrations, we are collectively telling cafes, pubs, bars and restaurants to close.
Last week, in response to rumours the capital would be put under lockdown, the Prime Minister went back and forth between insisting measures might have to be taken to trying to convince the public that things like transport will continue to be in service.
I'm sure through no fault of the media, but there's been a bit of misunderstanding floating around about that.
But then on Monday evening, as some in the UK sat down to tune into the latest episode of EastEnders, Boris Johnson addressed the nation to tell us to stay at home. But even that order came with some caveats.
Shopping for basic necessities as infrequently as possible. One form of exercise a day, for example, a run, walk or cycle, alone or with members of your household. Any medical need to provide care or to help a vulnerable person. And travelling to and from work, but only where this is absolutely necessary and cannot be done from home. That's all.
In what is for most an incredibly stressful time, and with the situation changing daily, has Boris Johnson struck the right tone? And in non-coronavirus news, a year after Alex Salmond was first charged with crimes relating to sexual assault, the former leader of the Scottish National Party was acquitted by a court in Edinburgh of all charges. Later on, we hear from The Guardian's Scotland correspondent Libby Brooks about what this means for the future of the SNP. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, as you're probably well accustomed to hearing, these are unprecedented times. I'm currently recording this in my office at home, aka the spare bedroom, and I'm not alone. My partner and kids are downstairs, and it's been tricky finding a way around an already packed work schedule, given how much is going on in Westminster right now. To be honest, it's been stressful. And I'm not the only one who thinks that. From chats with my colleagues over the last few weeks, I've realised how difficult it can be to report on something that isn't just political, it's a social problem, a national health emergency, and it's scary. Someone who knows this more than most is my colleague and great friend, John Crace, The Guardian sketch writer. Last Friday, in John's weekly column, he spoke about how he'd struggled to work through his anxiety. So I asked him to chat to me about what that's been like.
It's been such a weird one because, I am an anxious person at the best of times. And normally there's a sort of slight feeling of comfort in knowing that I am actually a bit mad and that and that I am out of sync with the rest of the world. And when I think there's some calamity coming, I can sort of talk to my wife, talk to friends, talk to colleagues, and get a kind of sense that not everybody is sharing that. And I kind of think I was probably one of the early adopters of the fact that coronavirus was going to be a sort of total disaster. And for a while, I felt sort of slightly out of lockstep with other people who kind of think, it's just flu, don't worry about it, that kind of thing. I did have a complete meltdown for about 4 days of sort of real and intense anxiety when I couldn't even get out of bed. I couldn't write. I couldn't do anything. But, friends, lobby reporters, plus a whole army of mental health professionals that have had my back for the last 25, 30 years all stepped up, and I feel tense every morning. I wake up with this sort of hollow feeling of a ball of fear in my stomach, and sort of have to fight it for about 15, 20 minutes before I can actually engage with the day.
But, you know, it's funny what you say about being out of sync with everybody else, because actually, you know, I've been feeling nothing on this on the scale of you, but I've been feeling, you know, incredibly anxious in the morning and unable to sort of put on my usual detached work persona. It's something that's so all encompassing that is affecting everybody and everybody's lives, isn't it? So you, to be honest, you were the trendsetter, John.
Early adopter of anxiety.
So we could say, couldn't we, this is all so all-encompassing, it's a kind of national emergency. Maybe it's not the time for sketch writing. Maybe it's not the time to try and be funny. But, is it the right thing to do? And do you find you can still find laughs in there?
The laughs are harder to find. There is no doubt about that. I mean, often when I've had anxious moments in the past, you know, periods of panic attacks and work has been a sort of distraction. It's been a solace for me. I've been able to disconnect from my free-floating anxiety, and the work has generally been very helpful. But now it's a sort of different situation. It's that the thing that I'm writing about is the very thing that's making me anxious. So there is a kind of sort of payoff there. But I think then my sketches have sort of changed. I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't feel there's anything remotely funny about coronavirus or, you know, the effect it's having on the country. And really, I suppose, I mean, without wanting to sound too grand about it, I kind of feel that the sketch writer's role now is to highlight the hypocrisy or the incompetence or the downright sort of mendacity of some of the government response, and to, you know, to play with that, if you like, you know, I mean, often making sort of, you know, jokes along the way, but hopefully sort of ones that resonate.
What do you make of Boris Johnson's handling of it? Because you're a close observer of his performances. I find the body language really interesting at some of those sort of Downing Street press conferences. There are bits of the message he seems very happy delivering and other bits not so much.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in a way Boris has been slightly found out. And again, in terms of the actual sketches, I kind of like to make them psychological pen portraits, because I'm very interested in the internal emotional toll that it's taking and the conversations that may be going on between Boris and himself. Because I think, but you know, we all know that it was Boris's life ambition to be world king, to be prime minister. But I don't think in his wildest dreams he ever imagined it was going to involve these kind of life and death decisions. And I really think he's hating it.
It must be. I mean, it is politics at its kind of most brutal or awful, isn't it? These sort of literally life and death decisions they're having to make.
Yeah, and he doesn't like it. And I mean, I wouldn't like it, but then I'm not the prime minister, which is sort of one of the many reasons I've never put myself up for election.
I would vote for you, John, if you did.
Oh, well, that would be very kind. I'd have one. I may a few more and I can maybe keep my deposit.
What do you make of some of the other characters we've started to see? So Rishi Sunak, we barely knew about until quite recently, suddenly playing this sort of rather statesman-like role.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he, you know, he is looking like a serious chancellor. I mean, a £330 billion bailout by any standards is a kind of big deal. I mean, I do think that he, again, has had a slightly easier ride than he otherwise might have done, because it again goes down to what we're being asked to believe. And this is where I think the sketch writer can play in again, because Boris and Rishi can say, we've been working day and night for the last 4 days to try and get this package. And you kind of think, but you've had 2 months of, you know, to prepare for this. We knew, you know, there was a possibility from the Chinese experience from sort of late December, early January, that this might become a pandemic and that what happened in China might spread across the world to Europe. And it appeared that during that time, they did absolutely no preparations whatsoever, or if they did, they were entirely casual. So, I mean, I think, you know, we're hearing that tomorrow we're going to hear what they're doing for the self-employed. And you kind of think, yes, but if you've had 2 months, 3 months almost to think about it, you know, you could have got this done earlier.
And you've essentially told a lot of the businesses that these guys work with to shut down.
Exactly. And with no kind of backup for them. And you've seen today also in the DWP Select Committee, there's 500,000 people, apparently, who've been trying to kind of log on for universal credit. And the DWP have been completely overwhelmed because they haven't got the staff. I mean, that's even assuming that the sort of universal credit system works properly, which to a large, for many people, even in sort of less anxious, less intense periods, it doesn't work particularly well anyway.
Do you think Matt Hancock's having a reasonably good war? We've always seen him as a bit of a, or sometimes seen him as a bit of a figure of fun, haven't we? Didn't get that far in the Tory leadership contest, but he's really in the line of fire, isn't he?
I've always actually had a kind of soft spot for him in my sketches. I mean, I've often portrayed him as Tigger out of Winnie the Pooh, sort of the really excitable, really keen, really over-optimistic. And I genuinely think he's doing a sort of decent job. And I mean, in the same way that Boris appears to have aged about 5 years in the last 2 weeks, so Matt Hancock appears to have done much the same. I mean, he now looks like he could go into an off licence and not be asked for his ID.
Yeah, exactly. John, I shouldn't let you go before mentioning the fact that you all have had your last opportunity to sketch Jeremy Corbyn at PMQs today. Did he bow out on a high?
I thought he sort of, it was more not with a bang, but with a whimper, really. I mean, he asked many of the right questions, but he didn't seem to capture, for me, the sort of right balance between going out in a kind of statesmanlike way and also a kind of gracious way. There was a sort of bit of, it was all a bit half-cocked, I felt. You know, I can't help feeling that once the Labour leadership election is over and we have a new leader in place, then PMQs should become a far more serious and more challenging session for both the Prime Minister and also the Leader of the Opposition.
Just going back to where we started this conversation, if there are people out there, and I'm sure there are, feeling very anxious at the moment, are there any tips you would pass on from your long experience?
Well, I've just sort of tried the nuclear option of everything. I've been listening to Zen meditation tapes, something I would never have dreamt of doing before. But the trouble is, they say, try and relax. And I think, I can't, that's the whole point, I can't relax. And I mean, the other thing, which we probably shouldn't be saying, because it's sort of, we don't want people to stop listening to the Guardian podcast or reading
them.
But do try and switch off from the news from the time being. I did find that I gave myself a news blackout for 24 hours over the weekend. And it did give me a bit of solace. You know, I kind of look for signs of hope wherever I can find them these days.
That was The Guardian sketch writer John Crace. There'll be a link to his article on today's episode description on The Guardian website. We'll also include links to some resources for those of you who might also be feeling anxious. Now joining me very much not in the studio is Jennifer Williams, politics and investigations editor for the Manchester Evening News. We had hoped to be joined also by Giles Wilkes, but unfortunately a technical car crash means we can't include him. Thanks very much to Giles, and we really hope to have you on soon. So, Jennifer, we watched Boris Johnson give this extraordinary statement on Monday night. The message from that was pretty clear, but there were quite a lot of bumps in the road in getting there, weren't there?
So it seemed to me that, about 5 weeks ago, there was when things were beginning to surface here, I watched a seminar that was held by the Royal College of Physicians for NHS staff in London, and it was had Chris Whitty on the panel and the lead for Public Health England and various eminent epidemiologists and so on. And actually, it seemed to me in the early days, the way that the government was carrying out its strategy seemed to fit broadly with what they had been saying to those doctors in the early days. So it didn't hugely surprise me that the government took the approach that it did. I do think that there's a political tension there, as you say, between Boris Johnson's kind of ideological desire for libertarianism and necessary measures which clearly came into play last week. And I think you could see that at one of those press conferences. I think it might have been the press conference where they closed the schools, or maybe the day after. And Patrick Vallance was asked whether people, you know, really needed to follow these social distancing rules and whether they really needed to stay at home and not go to the pub. And he said, yes, absolutely. And then it switched to Boris Johnson. And he immediately said something along the lines of, oh, well, I believe in people's individual ability to exercise their own judgment. And it seemed to me that in that moment, you could see that there was a tension there. Clearly, he has had to get over any underlying kind of political, you know, internal obstacles to that, as we've seen this week. And we're now where we are.
Yeah. And it reminded me some of his language of Gordon Brown early on in the financial crisis as well. I mean, he kept saying the fundamentals of the economy were sound when in fact they were being swept away. A lot of that project, that sort of Johnson project that we were all starting to talk about at the turn of the year when he had his lovely, comfortable majority, a lot of that would just be swept away now, won't it? I mean, politics is irrevocably changed by the last few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I think I keep thinking about how priorities and kind of cultural and social and political and even economic values might look when we come out the other side of this. And it feels a little bit sort of chin-strokey to be thinking about that at a point where we're not even at the peak yet. But I think that people's attitudes towards certain things are probably going to look quite different at the end of this. And it will be interesting to see how that then shapes this government going forward. Presumably they will come out of this at the other side. They'll still have a substantial majority. But what will people's attitudes be towards the state, for example? Will the public's priorities align with Dominic Cummings's worldview? Will people's views of other countries have changed? Will people's views of the BBC have changed? I suspect they probably will have done. Certainly, I'm sure there will be a strengthening of an already kind of very strong public cherishing of the NHS, but also potentially of social care, which has been undermined over a long period of time. My favourite hobby horse, local government. Local government's going to be on the front line in a humanitarian sense and in a practical sense of dealing with this crisis. So when we get out the other side, I think we'll be in a completely different space politically, and it's kind of difficult to know how that might change the priorities of the government that in the middle of December looked very different potentially in its outlook.
Right, we'll leave it there for now. After the break, we'll talk about how local authorities are responding to the crisis, and we'll hear from Libby Brooks on the ramifications of the Alex Salmond verdict. We'll be back after this. Hi everyone, Heather Stewart here. First of all, a huge thanks for listening to Politics Weekly. Secondly, we'd love to know what you think of this show, so leave us a review on iTunes or on the comments section of the podcast. During what we all now know to be these unprecedented times, we thought we'd take the time to get to know our listeners a bit and learn more about what you love to hear from your podcasts. Your opinions will be extremely valuable to us and will be used to help shape the future of Guardian podcasts. So if it's not too much to ask and you have some spare time on your hands, please head over to fill in our survey at guardiansurveys.com/podcast. Or alternatively, click on the link to the survey in the notes for this episode. As a thank you for your contribution, there'll be a chance for you to win a John Lewis voucher worth £250. Don't worry, we won't take any personal details other than an email address if you'd like to be entered into the prize draw. Can't wait to hear what you have to say. Thank you. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Jennifer, there's been quite a lot of cross-party not quite collaboration, but it's been quite a lot of support from Labour, hasn't there? John Ashworth, for example, has been very, very supportive. But it's started to fray a bit, hasn't it, in the last week or so? So Labour got a little bit ahead of the government and said you need to be locking down now. Sadiq Khan has made public his concerns about building sites in London still remaining open. Andy Burnham also has complained about the sort of ambivalence of some of these rules. What's the role of an opposition here?
Well, I think in the case of somebody like Andy Burnham, Sadiq Khan, or particularly Andy Burnham, I think what he has been trying to do is to say, I am supportive of the government. And I think, by and large, John Ashworth has been in this space as well. Supportive of the government, but it is my job to point out where the gaps are in this. So he's been pointing at things such as lack of support for the self-employed. He's been pointing at the ambiguity of some of the guidance around certain things, as has Sadiq Khan. But I think the nature of the politics in London, where Labour and the Conservatives are concerned, and perhaps the relationship that Sadiq Khan has with the government means that it's more combative. I think it's slightly less so with Andy Burnham. But having said that, he hasn't been shy to flag up where those gaps are. And I think that probably is Labour's role in this, is to be kind of broadly supportive, broadly collaborative. But where things are going awry, where things are being missed, it's their job to point out, hang on a minute, you need to be prioritising these things perhaps more than you are. You know, if you look at the way local government is going to be playing a role in this crisis, they are absolutely on the front line. And it's really noticeable during some of the press conferences, some of the interviews with ministers, and at yesterday's press conference, where the question was raised about parents with small children needing support and trying to work out exactly how to balance things. The advice is often to speak either to your local authority or to speak to one of these local hubs, which in many places have not yet been set up, but which are under local authorities' kind of responsibilities to set up. So an awful lot of the heavy lifting is being directed towards local government in this. But local government is still relying on central government to provide the resources and the guidance, which means they're aware of their responsibilities. They're trying to get some of what is effectively a humanitarian response set up. But they're still heavily reliant on departments in Whitehall to move quickly enough, provide the cash flow, provide the guidance, explain where actually the revenue for some of this is going to come from. So I do think that it has very neatly highlighted how essential those local layers of government are, but actually how they're doing a lot of stuff with one hand tied behind their back. Whether that changes anything on the other side of this is another question, because I think that the culture of centralisation in this country is so, so deeply rooted that, we'll see, won't we?
Yeah, and governments tend to come in talking about devolution, don't they? But we see precious little of it. It's certainly not being talked about, you know, sitting in those press conferences. Local government is one of the groups that, you know, we'll do whatever it takes to help workers. We'll do whatever it takes to help, you know, schools and businesses. But local government barely gets a mention, except, as you say, when we're told to contact them to ask them for help.
The local government underpins a lot of this support that the government is actually talking about. So hardship support will come via the local authorities. Support for small businesses will come via local authorities. Volunteering will be coordinated. Social care will be coordinated through local authorities. You know, all of the basic services that are going to have to continue going on behind the scenes will be provided by, a lot of that will be provided by local authorities. One thing that Andy Burnham raised was that the COBRA calls that the government is having has got the devolved leaders from the different nations on it, and I think possibly Sadiq Khan, but no other local leaders from outside of London. Now, I mean, realistically, do you want every local authority leader in the country on that call? Probably not. But there is an interesting question there about, as in any other walk of political life in this country, there is a danger there that then the onus becomes entirely on London. And let's be honest, the rest of the country is not that far behind London on the current graphs. So I think he raises an interesting point there about buy-in from other parts of England, certainly.
Now, before the coronavirus outbreak became headline news around the world, the UK political world was preparing for one of the most significant cases in Scottish legal history. On Monday, Alex Salmond, the former leader of the Scottish National Party, was acquitted of all charges relating to sexual assault in a trial that was tipped to have major consequences for the SNP and its campaign for Scottish independence. The Guardian's Scotland correspondent Libby Brooks reported throughout the trial. She has this report.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, Just over a year ago, when we finished the civil action and judicial review, I said I had great faith in the court system of Scotland. That faith has been much reinforced today. So I'd like to start by explaining that faith and thanking the jury for their decision. I'd also like to thank the court service.
It's impossible to overestimate Alex Salmond's significance to the SNP and to the wider Scottish independence movement. He led the party across three decades, becoming First Minister, turning it into a powerful electoral force, and also coming close to delivering a yes vote to independence in 2014. This story began in the summer of 2018 when the Daily Record newspaper revealed that the Scottish Government was investigating Alex Salmond for two claims of sexual harassment which were brought against him by women who had worked with him whilst he was First Minister of Scotland. And in the end, Alex Salmond actually brought a judicial review of the Scottish Government's handling of these charges. And in the end, the investigation fell apart. The Scottish Government was forced to pay out a lot of money to Salmond and also to admit that the investigation had been tainted with bias. But at the same time, the police were investigating these two allegations and more women came forward, so that in the spring of 2019, he ended up being charged with 13 counts of sexual assault brought by 10 different women. Now, these charges ranged from sexual assault to attempted rape. The women were a sort of wide range of Scottish Government officials, party workers, an SNP politician, all of whom had come into contact with him whilst he was First Minister. And the timings of the charges ranged from 2008 to just after the independence referendum in September 2014. From the very start, from the moment those first two sexual harassment allegations were made, Alex Salmond denied them categorically. He also has denied all of these 13 charges all the way through the police investigation and the trial. And when he was giving evidence in court last week, he described them as fabrications and exaggerations. There was one really shocking moment during the trial when one of the women who was accusing Salmond, witness G, alleged that the civil service actually introduced an unofficial policy of banning female civil servants from working with him late at night, after she had reported her allegations to her line managers. And certainly one of the things that is going to, I think, sort of be picked over and needs to be probed very thoroughly following this trial is the way that the civil service dealt with sort of complaints that were made about Salmond, whether, you know, they ultimately were found to be true or not.
As many of you'll know, there are certain evidence that I would have liked to have seen led in this trial, but for a variety of reasons we were not able to do so. At some point, that information, that facts and that evidence will see the light of day, but it won't be this day.
So on Monday afternoon, Alex Salmond sort of walked free out of the High Court in Edinburgh after his acquittal on these 13 charges of sexual assault. It was certainly the end of the trial, but it also marks the beginning of what I think is going to be an incredibly turbulent time for the SNP leadership. The Scottish Conservatives described it as a national political scandal with profound questions of integrity for the First Minister and her SNP government. There is going to be sort of immediately, or sort of as immediately as we can have, given the current lockdown because of the coronavirus, there is now going to be a parliamentary inquiry into the handling of the original sexual harassment complaints, and inevitably questions about Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister herself, what she knew about the process. Alex Salmond is very, very angry. His sense of betrayal through all of this has been ferocious, and he is not going to let up now until he gets what he sees as further justice.
It's a difficult situation, but what is important is that complaints are treated seriously, regardless of who the person complained about is. I have been very clear about my belief in the importance of that, and that's a principle that cannot be applied selectively, no matter how difficult that might be for me, for my party, or for others.
I mean, Nicola Sturgeon has already responded immediately to the verdicts and said that, of course, she accepts them, but most importantly, that her 100% focus right now has to be on this national global health crisis that is affecting all of us. At the moment, campaigning for Scottish independence is absolutely on hold. In fact, Nicola Sturgeon wrote to party members last week asking them to suspend campaigning and put all their focus into helping their communities. That said, there are, of course, a lot of concerns that infighting after the trial will be traumatic for the party, that it may, sort of in the longer term, leave activists feeling disillusioned and less motivated to go out and campaign for independence. But I think that is dependent on how people conduct themselves over the coming months, in particular how Nicola Sturgeon is seen to have handled the coronavirus crisis, and also how Alex Salmond behaves. It is inevitably very hard to gauge public reaction at a time like this. That said, Scottish Rape Crisis revealed that it had a big spike in calls to its helpline during the trial, prompted by the detailed reporting, which a lot of people found very upsetting. As far as the SNP goes in the longer term, obviously there are parliamentary processes that now have to be gone through with this inquiry. There are a few other investigations as well in terms of the Standards Commissioner, Information Commissioner and so forth. It's perhaps more broadly a question of how the party as a whole deals with it. I find it interesting, you know, before the trial, speaking to younger members of the SNP, and let's remember that the party has changed in its makeup significantly since Alex Salmond stepped down as First Minister just after the referendum in 2014. When Salmond stepped down, there was also this huge influx of new members to the party. A lot of them are younger people, a lot of them are women, a lot of them are LGBTQ+ activists. And I think they are sort of quite different to how the SNP has been in the past. And so when people talk about, you know, the rift between Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon and that sort of translating into an irreparable split in the party itself, I'm not sure that reads across quite as directly as that. And I think it misunderstands how the ground has shifted, not just because of these new members, but also because of the Me Too movement.
That's all from us this week. For more coverage on what impact the coronavirus outbreak will have on the global economy, the Guardian's Today in Focus podcast will continue to bring you stories by our brilliant reporters throughout the pandemic. Just look for Today in Focus on the Guardian website or wherever you get your podcast. And for anyone wanting to hear less about the politics and more about the science behind the coronavirus, the Guardian Science Weekly team are producing special weekly episodes where you can hear experts who are working on the front line explore some of the listeners' most pressing questions. Just search for Science Weekly on the Guardian website or wherever you get your podcasts. A huge thanks to our guests, John Crace, Libby Brooks, Jennifer Williams, and even though we couldn't hear from him this time, Giles Wilkes. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart. Please take care and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.